Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it is my pleasure to welcome you here today to our final Thursday Morning Roundtable program of this season. We will reconvene in September. So I'm glad you are all here today not to miss today's program, but I do want to, for those of you who are wondering what you can possibly do with your time next week, okay? I have a few commercials for you. First of all, on Monday, May 2nd, is a sustainability showcase at Syracuse University, open to the public. It's all day in the Shine Student Center. So this is a lot of student projects, really highlighting a lot of the things going on in the what does it mean to be green sustainability. So that's on Monday. On Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday at the On Center are the first public workshops that the State Department of Transportation and the Metropolitan Transportation Council are holding on the I-81 challenge. So you know that you should read the OCL report that Rebecca chaired a couple of years ago, and then go to one or all of these workshops. They're interactive. There's more information on the website, or you can call SMTC. But again, if I'm not mistaken, that's May 3rd and 4th in the late afternoon and evening, and May 6th, which is Saturday, during the day. On May 5th, Institute for Retired Professionals. Don't have to be retired to come. That's Thursday at noon. Len Berman, professor of practice, economist at the Maxwell School. He spoke to us earlier this season, I believe. He's going to be talking about the economy and how we can fix it. We might all want to be there and hear what he has to say. That's Thursday. Looking ahead a little bit, May 21st, Downtown Living Tour. Remember that? Actually, on May 12th, the Citizens League and the Downtown Committee of Syracuse are going to be receiving an award from the Preservation Association for our work in creating and carrying on that event. Hooray for us and them. If you'd like to volunteer at the event, call the Downtown Committee, because they've taken that over and making it even bigger and better, and it's a great way to showcase downtown. So, and I just gave a commercial for the Downtown Living Tour. Rob missed it. In case you don't know, it's May 21st. All right? So that's great. So thanks very much. But today is the day also when we make our annual award, TMR Award for Meritorious Service to the Community. Actually, today we have two awards, and the first one I'm going to tell you right off the bat is it was a non-TMR member. It was a little bit different, so we did a non-TMR member and a TMR member. The non-TMR member, many of you may know James Abbott. So wasn't able to be with us today, but maybe we can get him here next season and give him a round of applause for all of the work he did. He worked in healthcare, but his imprint goes well beyond that in the healthcare system, the health center. He was involved in that. We talked about last week and the hospitals and all of that. But the second one, as you know, I read this and we'll see, you know, look around at faces and see when it dawns on this person who the awardee is. Today we honor a person who is a true unsung hero. She gives generously of her time, skill, and energy, and does it with joy and verve and with little public recognition. She's a longtime member of TMR, OCL, and CUNA, that's the Southeast University Neighborhood Association, and has helped organize the Westcott Street Cultural Fair for many years. Her earlier volunteer activities included involvement with the Madison County Caring Coalition, the Coalition for Adult and Continuing Education, the City of Syracuse Drug and Alcohol Abuse Coalition, and serving as an advocate at the SU Rape Crisis Center. She's long been a promoter of education and training for women and girls in need. She's spending her retirement tutoring refugees in English and organizing anti-bullying efforts at the neighborhood elementary school. She also serves on the executive committee of the Board of Enable, an organization that empowers people with disabilities, and she's also past president and vice president of that board. For her contributions to the Central New York community, the Thursday Morning Roundtable is most pleased to present this award for meritorious community service to Virginia Fallaman. Ginny, come on up. And I'm also going to ask Rachel May to come up. Thank you so much. Congratulations, Jenny. Thank you. You can stay right here, but to introduce today's guest speaker, Mayor Stephanie Miner, who needs no introduction, but still, TMR member Kathy Richardson. Kathy was the co-chair of the mayor's transition team. Thanks, Kathy.
Never known to be that in my whole life. And Diane already stole my thunder. I was going to say, you're all thinking this is the easiest job in the world, to introduce somebody who needs no introduction. But let me tell you, I had to work very hard to try to find any facts that might be interesting to you that you don't already know. She is the 53rd mayor of the city of Syracuse. But what actually even surprised me, she's the first elected woman mayor of any of our big five cities in New York, which is terrific. And even though she's only been in office a few 16 months or so, she's already been able to accomplish a 10% reduction in the workforce, cut down overtime for the uniform and ununiformed employees. She's had the look of merger efficiencies right from the very beginning, and I think one of the big success stories is the merger of the economic development and the community development departments. So that's worked very well. For instance, the DPW and the water have their merged dispatch. Now, you might think that is, well, isn't that, you know, why isn't that a big, huge thing? But 52 other mayors never saw it. So anyway, but I think the big thing to me is the breath of fresh air that has moved across our community, and that we have a mayor and a county executive who trust each other and are looking to care about the constituencies, not their political clout, and that work at collaboration. And I think that they trust each other is very evident with the sales tax agreement that we've had. They're doing joint purchasing, mail rooms, economic development. They're going to be co-located, the two departments. And they're working on all the green initiatives on it. But I think that is just an indicator of the start that's happening. Now, I have to tell you, I talked to the mayor's staff and said, can't you give me any facts that nobody else really knows, like she hates chocolate, or maybe she really isn't of Irish descent. I mean, I was looking for anything, right? They first came up with a Rudy Giuliani story, of which I have one also. You're on your own to find out that one. It was a little too indelicate for this hour in the morning. And the next best thing they could come up with is that it's her birthday on Saturday. So pre-happy birthday. Now, I have to tell you, I'm a few months shy of being 30 years older than she is. I don't even remember the birthday she's celebrating on Saturday. So without further ado, our mayor, Stephanie Miner.
Thank you, Kathy. Thank you very much. As Sandra said, Kathy did me the great honor of co-chairing the transition committee, which was a substantive role involving hundreds of meetings and talking about subjects across the gamut. She did a fantastic job. And much because she did a fantastic job with that, I asked her if she would do me the honor of sitting on the Syracuse Industrial Development Authority, SIDA. I told her there's nothing that ever happens with SIDA. There's no controversy. Everything really runs smoothly there. And don't worry, you'll never be put under the microscope for anything that you do there. So I lied to her, but because Kathy is smart, she knew right away that I was lying, and nevertheless joined SIDA and has been an incredibly hardworking and effective member as we sort out an economic development policy that we believe can move the whole region forward, not just the city of Syracuse. And for her diligence and her work and her faithfulness in that, I am also eternally grateful. So thank you for that, too. Much as we all know, is Kathy has done tremendous work for this community in her multiple roles before her retirement, now during her retirement. I have to say a couple of words also, too, about Ginny. these two women illustrate what makes it so fantastic to be in public service in this community. Ginny, I first met in 2001 when I was running for the Common Council, I don't want to even say relatively unknown, a complete unknown. I was calling on Democratic committee people, and there was a woman named Tess Kossoff. I'm sure many of you in this room know Tess. And she said, there's a woman you have to meet, and she literally took me by the hand and walked me down the street to knock on Ginny's door. And we talked, and she said to me, you have to come to Thursday Morning Roundtable. And what I hope is a long list of following people's good advice. I came to Thursday Morning Roundtable oh so many years ago, and Ginny just reminded me, she said, you know, you said you would do it, and you did it. And as I said, I hope it's a long line of accomplishments where I follow people of good advice, like Kathy Richardson and Ginny, and I have found myself in this, having this deep privilege to be mayor of the city of Syracuse. When you hear the kind of accomplishments that Ginny does, I guess there's a part of me that is a little bit tinged with sadness that it doesn't say somewhere on that list of accomplishments that she's a member of the Democratic Committee of the City of Syracuse and that she helped in the year 2000 get a unknown candidate elected to Common Council, and then 8 years later had somebody of Irish descent and the accompanying temperament become elected to the mayor's office, because without Ginny's help, without Kathy Richardson's help, without many people in this audience's help in those very labor-intensive and no-glory-rich activities, I would not stand here today. So for that, I will always be eternally grateful. And before I launch into my presentation here, I do want to say one thing, and you are a group that is well known for the qualities of your questions. So I get asked a lot of the same questions these days. And one of them that I just want to put to bed right away is people say to me, do you regret running for the mayor's office? Are you upset that you're mayor? And I say, I think it is the most incredible honor that I've ever had in my life. And every day that I walk into City Hall, when I walk by my portrait on the wall, which took me 14 months to get there because I was so kind of queasy about it, my instant sensation is, what is my mother's picture doing on the wall? Then I remember, oh, wait, that's not my mother, that's actually me. I think what a fantastic privilege and honor it is to be in a place of leadership at a time when it really matters, in a community that cares about everyone in its community, at a time where we have an opportunity to really have meaningful change for the entire community, not just select subsets. So with that, let me launch into what is probably the trend that causes people to ask if I am still happy that I became elected mayor. The city of Syracuse's financial condition. We as the city of Syracuse are not alone in New York State in our financial distress. And our financial distress is not something new. It's, in fact, arguably been in the foreseeable future since the 70s. And it's really ultimately due to a lack of economic growth. But the same trends that are impacting Syracuse are impacting Buffalo, Rochester, Yonkers, Utica, every city in New York State, every city and county in New York State as well. In addition to which, this financial catastrophe that we are all looking square in the face is also nothing unique to New York State. In the past 2 days, there have been front page stories in the New York Times about what other states are doing and other municipalities are doing. In Michigan, for example, they have passed a law that allows the governor to supplant city councils and mayors and put in emergency financial managers. And that's what they've started doing in places in cities in Michigan. There are places in the far west that have stopped paying their pension costs as a way of sort of vigilante governance. I think it's also as an act of frustration to say there is nobody coming to either recognize the real problem and come with solutions to what is an untenable problem. As a mayor across the United States, when you are faced with choices of, do I take what little income I have, or we have, and use it to pay off exorbitant pension payments, which you will see have risen in the last year 40% for the city of Syracuse, and or healthcare costs, which are rising at an average of 10 to 15% for the city of Syracuse. And if I do that, which we are obligated to do, and if we don't have any help in trying to streamline these payments and get some predictability, then do I lay off police officers? Do I lay off firefighters? Do I lay off DPW workers? Do I lay off Department of Public Works workers? And the timing for these kind of questions is really, although my staff and the administration have told me that they are sick and tired of Mayor Minor's extreme weather, but if there is a silver lining to all the extreme weather that we have had since I have been mayor, from the incredible snowstorms to the incredible rain that we have had, it is this, that everyone recognizes, I believe, how important and vital to our entire community city services are. So if you were in your car 48 hours ago at 4 o'clock in the afternoon trying to get home or trying to get someplace, and there was a flash flood under Pete Street or on 81, you understood instinctually how important it is to be able to call 911 and to be able to have a police officer right there, to be able to have fire trucks. If you were in the middle of snowstorms and you were trying to get home or get to the hospital or even get to the dome to watch our basketball team, you instinctually understood how important it is to have snow plows out to be able to remove snow. These are the kind of vital basic services that are at risk because of the financial trends that are facing every municipality in our country and particularly every municipality in New York State. So with that, let's start at the beginning, as they all say. There we go. Here is a revenue analysis. For those of you who can't see, be thankful. I will hit the highlights for you. This slide shows a revenue analysis for the past 2 years and a projected for next year. And it shows where we get our revenue from and as percentage of the budget. And what essentially it shows is the only place that we have had any growth in our revenue has been in sales tax because of the sales tax agreement that the county and the city entered into last year. Every other revenue has been flat or declining. While state aid remains the single largest part of our budget, it's projected this year at $75.4 million, at 33% of our budget. In 2008-09, the state gave us $85 million. So in 4 years, the state has cut us $10 million. That is $10 million, which obviously you can see from this, we can't make up in revenue. So what do you do as a mayor when you are faced with that kind of scenario of flat revenues? Well, the first place you start to look is what can we control on our side, on our expenditure side? And this is what we have done for the budget year 10-11. We cut $4.4 million from our actual budget numbers. This is not from growth or from anything else. This was a budget that I put into place that we were able to cut from that $4.4 million. We were able to, through the early retirement and being very, very strict in the early retirement implementation, we were able to vacate 93 positions through that program. And as of March 2010, we were 200 employees fewer than December of 2009. So in that intervening 14 months, 200 people fewer. Now, that is not to say that in December of 2009 there was a lot of fat in the city of Syracuse in terms of employment. These cuts have actual impacts and actual feelings in terms of not just the people who are being cut or the jobs that don't exist anymore, but the services that we can deliver. We did a dramatic reduction in the overtime for the Department of Public Works, for the police department, despite record calls for our services. We had more calls for police for shots fired, as you all know, because you all read the paper. We've had the number 4 record snowstorm fall in the history of the area. So we have had incredible demands for these services, and yet by being tight fiscal stewards, and my department heads would call me a Grinch, we were able to significantly reduce that amount of money that we are spent. Despite that, we have, when we put together, this is, if anything, this will be the most important slide that we talk about today. Despite being able to save $4.4 million, implementing an early retirement program, saving on overtime, cutting positions, because of our projected expenses, and most particularly, in fact, exclusively, the ones that are not within our control, we continue to have to dip into our fund balance, our savings account, our rainy day fund, whatever you want to call it. What this bar graph shows, the red bar is the New York State Comptroller's guideline for how much we have to have in fund balance. The New York State Comptroller says that we have to have 5% of our revenue or expenditures in our fund balance to remain fiscally viable. And that's about between $9.9 and $11.5 million, depending on which accountant you talk to. What this shows is that we are drawing down our fund balance such that in fiscal year 12-13, we will be below where the comptroller says is for us to be fiscally viable. Now, what that means is that when other municipalities have approached this, they have entered into financial control boards. And there are different models for financial control boards in New York State and in the United States. But what this means is that unless we get reform that changes these trends, that is what we as a city are going to be faced with. Now, I stood here and I said to you, we've saved all this money, and this is what we've done in the first 2 years that I've been mayor, and yet there are things that are beyond my control. Lindsay, would you go to the next slide. Let's look at pension costs, just as an example. In fact, the most important example you'll hear every New York State official talk about pension costs. In the year 2010-2011, our total pension costs were $19.8 million. In 11-12, it's $28 million. On top of a four-year $10 million cut from New York State, on top of flat property taxes, revenue, and almost no growth, on top of by law mandated salary increases that we have to give. There is nothing that I can do about these pension costs. The state does not ask for my input, my assistance, or are we even part of the discussion about what their benefits should be, what their retirement age should be, how much they should or in fact should not contribute to their pension system. This is a simple fact of the state sending us the bill. And E.J. McMahon, who has been quoted across the board in New York State and is kind of a expert, not kind of, is an expert in New York's pension crisis, has said that over the next 5 years, contributions to the teachers' retirement system will more than quadruple. And over the next 5 years, contributions to the New York State local retirement system will more than double. So if I have $28 million and I then, 3 years from now, will have to pay $56 million, and you just saw the fund balance and you saw what I was able to do to scrape it, where do we go to do that? Here's another interesting fact. Do you know the state pension office will not give us numbers, projections, any more than 2 years in advance? Do you know why that is? The conspiracy theorists among the mayors say because the numbers are so scary that there would be widespread panic and rioting about what this will do. Now, $28 million, $10 million cut from New York State. Again, in the backdrop of, on the last major snowstorm that we had where everybody lost their mind because it had been such a long winter and it was like enough already. We had three snowplows go down. Three snowplows that were purchased in the 80s. that had been effectively on the road 24 hours a day, 7 days a week since the snow started falling in November. We are having difficulty finding financing to purchase snowplows. What happens to this community if the city of Syracuse can't plow its streets? Now, not just because we can't hire or afford the personnel to drive the plows, but also we can't even afford to purchase the plows because of our pension costs. That's what you are looking at when you look at these numbers. The next issue, health insurance. Now, there are all of you here, because you're members of TMR, very sophisticated, and so you say, well, Mayor, you say health insurance is outside your control, yet I know you are a labor lawyer, and you bargain health insurance because most of your employees are collectively bargained. True. However, the two largest groups of employees are police and fire. They are also the two most expensive services that we as a city provide, and also the two highest paid groups of employees. Policemen and firemen in New York State have a right to enter into what's called interest arbitration, binding interest arbitration, which means you collectively bargain, management and the union, then you get to an impasse. And when you get to that impasse, then a neutral third-party arbitrator is hired who then decides what the actual terms and conditions of employment will be. This arbitrator does not have to, by law, look at or examine a municipality's ability to pay. This arbitrator doesn't have to be from Syracuse or Central New York, and the arbitrator often, frankly, is not from Syracuse or Central New York. So, our experience and the experience of mayors across the state has been that these arbitrators, and this could be a bias from because of where we sit, but I think that this will illustrate the point, that these arbitrators are not really interested in cities crying poverty. Perhaps because cities have cried poverty for so long before, we're like the boy who cried wolf, but now there's a real wolf in the room, and they're like, yeah, I've heard this story before. But let me show you what happens here. Monthly employee contributions for health insurance, for family coverage for police and fire. Again, our highest paid employees who are subject to binding interest arbitration, and with the police department in particular, have gone to binding interest arbitration for the past 10 years or so. For family coverage, these employees pay $27.69 a month. Now, I have done more than a little research on this. The employees at the Post Standard, just to take an organization, for family coverage, I'm told pay $85 a week for family coverage. The plumbers, unionized plumbers, a high skill set, who on average make between $30,000 and $40,000, are paying... I just lost the number. They're paying. Well, I don't want to misstate the number. It'll come back to me. So the newspaper's paying $85 for family coverage a week. When you look at what I did, this comparison does is show active coverage for the neighboring public sector employees. I did not even put private sector employees on this graph. In Onondaga County, active family coverage, they're paying $125 a month. In New York State, they're paying $236 a month for family coverage. In the federal government, it is over $400 a month. So my highest paid employees, our highest paid employees, who are subject to binding interest arbitration, are paying the lowest for health insurance of any of their neighbors. And the interest arbitrator gave his, and it was a he, it always has been, his blessing to these numbers. When you look at what healthcare is actually costing us and what they have to pay for a month, this is completely inequitable. And then when you say, okay, so because of binding interest arbitration, the city as management has no real control over how much they pay for health insurance. Because of the way the state has designated the pension system, the city has no control over pensions. You are now understanding that we are at the whim of the state to help us change that. And that's why I have over and over and over again said we need meaningful reform from the state to change these trends. And again, these trends are not unique to Syracuse. Buffalo is already in a financial control board because of these trends. Rochester may be 2 to 3 years out for a financial control board. Nassau County is in a financial control board. Think about that in this context. Nassau County is the second most wealthy county in New York State, which means it is arguably one of the wealthiest counties in the United States. And they are in a financial control board. Where we haven't had economic development growth, Nassau County has had tremendous growth, tremendous increase in property values. And because of these trends, they are in a financial control board. The city of Buffalo, one of the poorest cities in New York State. So you have a wealthy county that's had tremendous growth and a poor city on opposite ends of the state still being forced to the same place. There is a common denominator, New York State. The next slide. This is active and retiree health care. We in the city of Syracuse still provide retiree health care. It is something that is almost non-existent anymore in the private sector. What these numbers show you is that we are now what is called by the experts upside down. We are spending more on health care for retirees than we are on active members. Again, another trend that is bad. So where does this leave us in terms of the city of Syracuse? Where this leaves us is that we had a choice about how to handle this information. We could ignore it, which other municipalities have done, and arguably some are currently doing, and say, when the financial control board comes or when it hits us, everybody acts surprised, and that way we can blame other people. Or we could own up to it and say, yes, these are the trends that are coming down, and try to work the system to get reform, which in itself is a scary idea given the history of the New York State Legislature and what we have seen as New Yorkers. To say, no, we're going to be open about this information and we're going to say to Albany, we need your help, and we're going to, in fact, put our livelihoods or the fate of our government in large part on Albany enacting reform and meaningful change. That's the path that I have chosen. It is something that I think all people in this community deserve. And in fact, that I need your help in order to engender the kind of mindset among certain legislators. And I will say that Senator DeFrancisco, Senator Valesky, Assemblyman Magnarelli, and Assemblyman Roberts have been very open to this. I have met with them. They understand it. In large part, I think we're very fortunate. I consider us very fortunate in that Senator DeFrancisco and Assemblyman Magnarelli came directly out of city government. They served on the city council. They understand. They know firsthand the kind of services that we provide and the kind of struggle, financial struggle that we're under. And they recognize the kind of things that we have done in order to put our own house in fiscal order. Which, truth be told, the slide that I skipped, which is the rating agencies, our house has been in very good financial order in terms of what we can control. And this has been noticed by and published, heralded by the rating agencies, who have given us A ratings with positive outlooks based on the work that we have done, based on our fiscal discipline in terms of bonding, based on the fact that we have consolidated and sales tax and all of these things have given us A ratings with positive outlooks. The last time they did our rating, they do it every year, they noted, though, the trends that we are subjected to. And they went and said that unless there is a change in these trends, that will force them to downgrade our bond rating. Well, that's what they get the big bucks in Wall Street to do. And it's no secret to those guys that we can't control our pension costs, we can't control our health care costs, and they have a much prettier bar chart with a lot more dots and statistical regression analysis on it that shows exactly what I showed you. So if the rating agencies decide, they're coming next month, decide that there is no hope in Albany and that there is really effectively nothing that we will be able to accomplish. You could see the Financial Control Board issue pushed faster, because once they downgrade our ratings, it becomes more expensive for us to bond, and we are beholden to bonding in order to pay our expenses and move the city forward and provide services. That's how we do it, through the bond market. And so if they say, no, Syracuse, we're downgrading you because of these things, and again, it won't be just us, it'll be downgrading across the state, then you'll see us continue to move faster. So that is my, that's why I started off telling you that I'm still very thankful to be mayor of the city of Syracuse. To talk about the idea that challenges represent opportunities, and if we did not have the challenges that we have as a community, then we would not be able to institute or implement real meaningful change. You can't threaten a culture until, or change a culture until that culture is threatened. And the way that we have been forming our government has not been sustainable for a long time. And the way that we have been providing services has not been sustainable for a long time. It has been masked by, you know, Wall Street, by Albany, but now those masks are getting peeled back. And it's a question of, really, will we as a community, will we as a state be part of positive solutions and make sure that each of our elected officials, myself included, sit down and find solutions to these trends, or will we allow the trends to take over us? I think that we are entirely capable of having this change, of having positive discussions, of coming to meaningful solutions to these. Not ones that everyone will agree on, but ones that can put us on the right path for fiscal sustainability. And while we all, I'm sure, have different views about the New York State budget that was passed, the process that the legislature and the governor went through to get to that budget, and the fact that we got an on-time budget, I think was very positive and showed that as a disparate group of people that we can sit together and say that we need to continue to move forward as a state, and we cannot let dysfunction become the rule of the day. So with that, let me get to what you're really all here for, which is questions.
Mayor, I assume that the pension plan is a defined benefit plan, not a defined contribution plan?
Correct.
Okay, and many organizations, governments have frozen their plans. Is that on the horizon? I know that still would involve a lot of payment because you still owe the contribution.
Yeah. Well, and let me say a couple of things. I believe, both as a person and as a mayor, that people are entitled to their pensions. And the New York State Constitution, much more importantly than my belief, says that once you are vested in that pension, you're entitled to that. So there are we need short-term solutions in terms of, okay, we're going to have these costs. How do we pay for them? Which I think should look like the state coming to us and saying, we will give you no-cost or low-cost loans to amortize these payments out over a period of time so you won't have 40% increases every year. The longer-term reforms, which you're talking about, other states have been talking about transitioning from defined benefit to defined contribution. I have not heard anybody other than E.J. McMahon and the Manhattan Institute talk about that kind of transition. What the private sector did 20 years ago, the public sector is now facing. And I am very ambivalent about it, because a defined contribution plan, well, when I was in the private sector up until 2 years ago, that's what I had. There are risks to that, as we all know. On the employee, but there are also risks in terms of the quality of life that employee has. Given what Wall Street has, its recent history and what it's done, and this incredible divide between the have and the have-nots that exist in this country, do I want to put my pension and retirement subject to that? Do I want to put our employees subject to that? And is there some middle ground that we can meet where we say, you know, we're all entitled to, after spending a lifetime working, to a retirement where you can afford groceries, heat, and food, and a quality of life? So the short answer to your question is I have not heard anybody meaningfully talk about that transition from a defined benefit to a defined contribution plan. I believe that if we can get short-term solutions and long-term solutions, that we will not have to necessarily move to that. But if the state does not address these crises in a meaningful way in the very near term, what you're going to see is dire decisions. Because the longer it takes for the state to come in and implement these solutions, the more the solutions get much more dire.
Good morning, Mayor. This is a follow-up to the pensions. My understanding, they're primarily in terms of the contribution by municipalities, is how much you need in basically in the stock market, for all intents and purposes, to generate the revenues when you need the money to come back out, et cetera. We had a financial collapse a couple of years ago, but up until then, pretty much we were fully funded, as I understand it, at the state level. And the municipalities were not contributing much because there was enough being generated by the market itself. My understanding is pretty much the market has come back to where it was about 2 years ago. And we are still fully funded, as I understand, at the New York State level. I don't understand why there's this need for additional revenues from individual municipalities, almost like a catch-up provision of some sort, that you're being forced to give. Does that make sense?
It does. And let me say that there are people who herald the fact that we have a fully funded pension system. Certain elected officials say that. And yet they're sending us bills for $28 million. Now, part of the answer to your question about how can you all of a sudden be getting these huge bills, is because they were not accurate and perhaps they were over-exuberant with the return that they thought the market would give us. In other words, they thought that the market would continue to give us 8, 9, and 10% returns year after year after year. It hasn't happened, and I think it won't happen. And because of that sort of falsity in the interest rate prediction, which at the time then gave all of these great political choices that people had. Okay, if we boost this fake interest rate projection, then we can turn around and we can increase benefits. We can tell municipalities, at least in the short term, that they don't have to pay, or we can also insulate how much that they do actually have to pay. So the factors that were put into the projections were, depends on your view, not accurate, and they were not conservative. And some may even say that they were deliberately liberal. And so, sure, you can say it's a fully funded pension system. It isn't this great, and everybody who's on the New York State retirement system gets this notice saying, you know, how great our pension system is. And those of us who are in mayors and county executives are looking at these bills and saying, yeah, you're heralding that because you're just turning around and sending us the bill. When we amortize, which we have to do in order to pay that bill, and we can only amortize a certain portion of it, the state is turning around and charging us interest that is over and above what we would have to pay if we did general obligation bonding. So if we bonded our pension payments, we'd have to pay 3% interest. The state is charging us anywhere between 5 and 7. So the state's making money off of me that way too, off of us that way too. But when you look at the benefits, and they are rich benefits, and then you look at people's the actuarial tables, and you just have to project it out. And the Manhattan Institute has a really interesting table on their website where they say, okay, you want to have a teacher's retirement in Nassau County gets $75,000 a year. Then you put that in, and it shows you how much you have to contribute every year for that teacher to reach the end of their natural lifespan. And you start to see the beauty of what my father always told me of compound interest, which I never really understood. Now I do.
I also wanted to remind the folks in the room that it had to be 6 years ago, at least, when we were doing one of the Citizens League studies, and we had Dave Moynihan, the city's independent auditor, and the city and county budget directors here. I remember clearly, if he didn't say the wolf was in the room, he did say the wolf was at the door, you know, regardless of whatever was going on with the stock market at that time. So it seems to me it must have been more than just that, because it was a dire warning, and we said the train wreck was coming.
And keep in mind, too, that I think, a useful exercise to compare the private sector and the public sector, just because I think there's a more conservative, realistic approach on some things, and this thing in particular on pensions. In the private sector, most people retire at 63 or 65. In the public sector, it can be 55 or 57. In the private sector, you have defined contribution 401ks. In the public sector, you have defined benefits. So you have all of these things that, as a group, make it a much richer benefit. Also, in the not unimportantly, in the private sector, you contribute to your retirement. In the public sector, you don't.
You mentioned the horrors of having an outside fiscal manager for the city. I don't know if I'm using the right term. So the question is, would you tell us, what does that mean? What happens when you have something like that?
When you have a fiscal control board, the first item that the fiscal control board does is it vitiates all collective bargaining agreements. Vitiate is a fancy legal term for meaning it suspends, it ends all contracts. So all terms and conditions of employment that have been agreed upon by the city and the unions, who cover 98% of our employees, will be put aside. Healthcare, all of the things, entitlement to overtime, scheduling, all of those kind of issues. We have in this year's budget $500,000 of raises that we have to give under law, so-called contractual step increases, even though we are in negotiations with all of our unions. Part of what we have to do pursuant to New York State collective bargaining law is we have to give them those. If and when we were to go to a financial control board, we would no longer have to do that. So the employees effectively become unrepresented by unions. It gives the Financial Control Board and arguably the executive branch a lot more latitude when it comes to terms and conditions of employment. So are there benefits to a Financial Control Board? Sure. But there are different models. There's a model that New York City used in the 70s. There's a model that Buffalo used. There's a model now that Nassau County used. There's a model that Yonkers has used. But effectively what it becomes is a super board that every decision that you make regarding spending, and in particular your budget, goes to that board and they have to sign off on.
You and the president are both subjected to term limits. Many of us feel that this should be the situation for other elected officials. I'd like to ask you how you feel about this, and also how we can go about getting this situation enacted.
Term limits?
Yes.
I am deeply ambivalent about term limits. Before I came into office, I was... No, not the way you think. Don't predict. I'm an iconoclast, you know. Before I came into office, I was dead set against term limits. I thought that they were deeply undemocratic and that the people should be the ultimate arbitrators of whether somebody's doing a good job and should stay in office. Then I got elected to the city council, and from my time on the city council, I was subjected to them as well. It's not just the mayor, it's the city council as well. And I started to see firsthand the kind of turnover that term limits allow to happen and the kind of new blood that you force to go through the system, which I think is a very good thing. And so now, as mayor, I'm very happy I have the job. Did I think when I ran for the job, geez, I can only have the job for two terms? No. I thought, I want to have the job for one term, and I'll make that other decision down the road. I can say pros and cons. I feel strongly both ways. I don't know how you would have to go to each different level of government and look at the laws that they have that control their election laws. So, for example, while the city council has term limits, the county legislature does not. Obviously, the state of New York does not, and the federal House of Representatives does not. There is a beauty, though, in having somebody who gets enough stature into a system where they can become experts and they get a lot of leadership and ability to really influence policy and your area. So you have to talk to those who are in charge of New York State and the federal government, and I am not one of those.
Mayor, you mentioned that we have these challenges, and that's great because we can look at them as opportunities. But it's often difficult to look at a challenge as an opportunity until it becomes a crisis. I mentioned in the introduction that the I-81 challenge is we're in the midst of that project of something having to be done with the viaduct that goes through downtown. And the public will have a chance to have its input, and some of us are on committees, and you have staff who are on committees. But right now, there are millions of dollars worth of studies going on, hopefully looking at different scenarios and using different assumptions about what the city is going to look like in 20, 30, 50 years. Do you, given that you're dealing with lots of wolves in the room right now, do you see a way that we can use that challenge and the activities that are going on now to as an opportunity to help plan some new scenarios for the city? Is there a way that we can use that, even though at this point it's still in the planning process? And
are you speaking about I-81 in particular?
Well, just using the whole process, really. I think it's bigger than I-81, but using the process for thinking about how we as a community are going to grow.
Well, I have a planning and sustainability department, and they spend a great deal of time planning and being sustainable. No, I'm being facetious. They do spend a great deal of time doing plans and thinking about where we are as a city and using mapping technology and vacancy rates. So we are constantly thinking about what the city will look like in 10 years or in 20 years or in 30 years. But most importantly, what I think the role of elective government is to make the policy decisions about where what we want that to look like. And so while the planning experts and the mapping experts may all get together in a white room with their slide rules and their calculators and their Mac computers, what I view as my role as the chief elected official is to say, here is the policy. So that's a very inarticulate way of saying, well, what does that really mean? Well, what that means is when the folks come to me and say, hey, I-81, we've got this I-81 issue, what do you think? Well, I, as mayor of the city of Syracuse, think that the purpose of a city is to have neighborhoods and people to move freely between those neighborhoods. And I-81 represents an architectural barrier to the free movement of people, and that my city does not exist to get people from north to south quickly. It exists to enforce the interaction. And accordingly, the planning that we do and the thinking that we do about it will be with that rationale and or goal in mind.
Thank you. We have questions on the other side. Excuse me.
What's going on with Destiny?
Not much. They you can see for yourselves, not much is going on. And they settled with Citibank. SIDA signed off on that settlement as was necessary. And SIDA believes, and the mayor concurs, that in an open and transparent government, such that we believe that those documents should be released to the public, the settlement documents. Destiny's lawyers do not believe that. SIDA voted to allow those documents to be released to the Post Standard under a Freedom of Information request. Destiny has an appeal to that. But in terms of, is there going to be an open expansion and are there tenants and what's going to happen to that, I am not the person to ask.
You strike me as someone who enjoys the challenge of all this that's going on, but I'm wondering, when you put your head on the pillow at night, what are the best things about being mayor of Sirk?
There are a lot. There are a lot. And sometimes, like last night, you put your head on the pillow and then you rise it up instantaneously when you hear more rain. And you're like, please stop raining. The best part about being mayor is that you have the ability to impact meaningful change at a time when it matters. You have the ability to make people's lives better. That also means you have a responsibility. And sometimes inadvertently, or you can't do enough, you make people's lives worse. The best part day to day is that for the first time in my life, I have been able to surround myself with people of my own choosing. I got to choose everybody who's around me. And I enjoy them all a great deal. They are all very different from me, from each other, and the kind of creativity that comes from having this group of people who are committed to the future of the city of Syracuse, committed to having a urban, sustainable city where neighbors know each other and interact. I enjoy coming to work every day, and I laugh every day. And there are some days where we cringe and we cry, but we laugh more than we do the latter.
The county legislature just went through a redistricting process, and there was a lot of politicking back and forth, but part of the rationale was that it was a move to try and create more of a sort of a metropolitan viewpoint within the legislature. What's your take on that?
That may have been part of the rationale for the redistricting. I don't think that that's what drove it. There are experts who have written about and even opined on the size of the Onondaga County Legislature who said it should be dramatically smaller. And I don't know where they got this number of eliminating two, but it wasn't through, I think, any meaningful substantive analysis. Did the county legislature redistrict to suit their needs? Sure. Was there gambling in the casino? Yes, that's what happens. If they are allowed to do that and nobody calls them on the carpet for it, well, that's the way the system works. So if you believe, or if you have reason to believe, that the process was flawed or the end result is not up to what we as a community deserve, then you need to let your county legislators know. What I have been most surprised by as mayor is that there are officials who are able to hide from decisions or hide from the decisions that they make. That is not helpful for our community. That is not helpful for us moving forward. The only thing that changes that dynamic is when folks like you get involved in it. I came here and talked about this, about sales tax. And you all rose to the challenge, and because I was CC'd on a number of emails and letters that you all sent to your county legislators saying, we care about the city, we believe in the city, we believe the city is vital to the future of our region. Please keep that in mind as you make your decision. It was very successful. The decisions that are made, you need to, it's a form of democracy. People need to know that they are being observed, watched, and judged. Because that's what public servants do. And if they feel like they can act in hide and they're not going to be held accountable, the lack of accountability is a surefire way for the demise of public policy.
Mayor, since you brought up gambling in the casino, there I've heard some people who agree with you on most things who maybe take issue or don't quite understand your stance with regard to bringing off-track betting to the city at all or to a particular area of the city. Could you just explain your thoughts on that.
Sure. I don't smoke yet. Smoking is a legal activity. I don't gamble. Gamble is a legal activity. In this extent, I think you could say I'm kind of a libertarian. The government has said that smoking and gambling are legal. Do I participate in those activities? No. Maybe I should add the third one. Drinking. I do drink. Sometimes it helps. The government has said that all three of those activities is legal. I'm a libertarian. If you want to engage in legal activity, I think it's your right. And your right ends where, you know, the proverbial my nose begins. But I am not a moral authoritarian, and I don't believe my role as mayor of the city of Syracuse is to be a moral authoritarian and to make judgments that have already been put into law and deemed legal. Now, that's how I start off. OTB is legal, and it is occurring outside the county. And so people from the county are driving to OTB parlors to engage in a legal activity. And those counties are getting tax money for that legal activity. I need money. I think you understand that. So if it's a legal activity, and if they, why shouldn't they be allowed to do it in Onondaga County? So I would say this to you. Do the same analysis with smoking and with drinking. I don't smoke, but I get tax revenue from cigarettes. Do I wash my hands of it and say, I know I'm morally opposed to smoking. It causes cancer. It's a bad thing, which I believe personally it is. But government says it's legal. It's a legal activity. People can buy cigarettes in Onondaga County in the city of Syracuse, and I'm going to take that revenue, and I'm going to use that revenue to help pay my police officers and firefighters and plow the streets and my city employees. Drinking is a legal activity. People should be allowed to drink in the city of Syracuse and Onondaga County, and I'm going to take the revenue that comes from that.
Thank you. Thanks, Mayor Minor, for coming and joining us today.